Take your Wi-Fi further with wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity. With fast speeds and reliable coverage, home just got even sweeter with the Xfinity 10G network. Restrictions apply. Not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary.
From KQED.
From KQED in San Francisco, I'm Alexis Madrigal. Over the last few weeks, a whole quiver of articles have come out about divorce. The Cuts was titled, The Lure of Divorce. The Atlantic's headline read, A Grim View of Marriage and an Exhortation to Leave It. In part, that's because there are several big new books that center the experience of women choosing to leave their marriages, like Liz Lenz's This American Ex-Wife and Leslie Jamison's Splinters. But to talk of divorce is to call in marriage, too. And the upwelling of all the talk about open marriages speaks to a larger reevaluation of the institution. So this morning, Jamison and author Tracy Clark Flory join us to talk about the reality and discourse of divorce. They're coming up next after this news. Welcome to Forum. I'm Alexis Madrigal. In some ways, for me, this show began a couple of years ago when I interviewed Florence Williams about her book Heartbreak, because this one bit really stuck with me. I'd always heard the folk statistic that half of marriages end in divorce, but the whole truth is quite a bit different. For one, divorce rates peaked in 1980 and have been falling pretty much ever since. The divorce rate is now lower than it was in 1970. And for certain subgroups, especially people with college and graduate degrees, the rates have gotten astonishingly low. Williams discovered that for women like her who'd gone to grad school and gotten married in the 90s, the divorce rate was just 14%. Which is to say, divorce is both a remarkably common experience in this country and in certain places and among certain income and educational groups. It can still feel transgressive, lonely, maybe even unthinkable. And when I started thinking about who I wanted to talk to about divorce and marriage, I knew I wanted Tracy Clark Flory, whose newsletter I follow religiously. She always has a clear-eyed, full-hearted view of what's going on in her own life and our collective world. So thank you for joining us, Tracy.
Thanks so much for having me.
And then I read Splinters by Leslie Jamison. Oh, my God. It was so good on the subjective experience of divorce that I almost couldn't keep reading it after about 20 pages of such finely observed joy turned to pain and loss. But then I not only didn't put it down, but got sort of hiding in the bathroom reading obsessed until I finished it. And it just so happens that Leslie is here in town on book tour, and I'm so delighted to have her here this morning, too. Thank you for coming, Leslie.
It's fantastic to be here. Thanks for having me.
Tracy, each of these different memoirs that center women's experiences of divorce are distinct and interesting in their own ways, but they also don't stand alone, right? And I'd love you to kind of contextualize these books and how you think they relate to the broader conversations that are happening about the institution of marriage right now.
Yeah. So, you know, clearly we've had this influx of narratives about divorce and also this, you know, huge resounding reader interest in these narratives. So there's Leslie's book, there's Liz Lenz's book, This American Ex-Wife. And then, you know, just last month we had Emily Gould with her viral personal essay in New York Magazine, where she very candidly, you know, writes about her considering divorce and ultimately deciding against it, but walks us through that sort of decision process. Last year, we had Maggie Smith's book, You Could Make This Place Beautiful, another divorce memoir that hit the bestseller list. So to me, readers are clearly saying we want these stories, but it's also about more than divorce. Like, I'm noticing a bunch of attention getting essays and books that really get at challenging the patriarchal status quo around marriage, motherhood, and sex. So whether that's around, you know, a memoir that explores polyamory within a long-term marriage, or a book that, you know, draws a connection between the coercions of rape culture and the coercions of the culture of motherhood.
You interviewed that author, I think, yeah?
Amanda Monti, yeah. Touched Out, an excellent book, yes. And so I think when you look at all of these books and essays together, there's this intense grappling with the inequities in women's lives and also the structural forces that sort of control their lives, often within the institution of heterosexual marriage.
Mm-hmm. What's your own relationship to marriage?
I am married. I've been married for 10 years. Just recently celebrated our 10-year anniversary. But I'm also a person who walked down the aisle to the Mission Impossible theme song. So that tells you a little something about the sort of skepticism that I brought to the whole endeavor. And that was like, you know, a winking commentary about the divorce statistics, but also the absurdity of like judging a relationship by its ability to endure until death, and as well as the inequities that are kind of baked into it and the way it's an institution that's been used to oppress women since always, and yet deciding to participate in it anyways, which brings a lot of contradiction and cognitive dissonance. And so while I'm happily married, I sit with that discomfort with the institution itself.
Yeah. We're talking about divorce, which means we're also talking about marriage with Tracy Clark Flory and Leslie Jamison. And we'd love to hear from you. I mean, how have your own ideas about divorce changed over time? You can give us a call. The number is 866-733-6786, or you can email forum@kqed.org. Leslie, I wanted to recognize that your book is so incredibly, remarkably specific. It's like, it's not a cynical surfing into the wave of divorce memoirs. It's your life, you know? How do you relate, though, your life and your work to, you know, to this broader conversation around marriage and divorce?
Yeah, I think it's a fascinating way into not only maybe the particular story about marriage and divorce and motherhood and transformation and the ways a self is sort of perpetually undone and remade by experience on a daily and yearly basis, but also maybe a way into a conversation about what role literature can play in larger cultural conversations about life, so that, you know, I feel that telling a particular story in the form of a memoir is never meant to be representative, but the hope is always that there are truths in there or kernels of experience or tensions or dilemmas that speak, you know, not only to other people who have been married or divorced, but even just to other people who have tried to sort of hold on to the beauty of a thing that has ended, whatever that thing is, which is in a way the one of the driving preoccupations of the book. I mean, I think I love that you walk down the aisle to the Mission Impossible theme song. There's a moment in my memoir where I describe we got married at midnight in Las Vegas, you know, where all sturdy
all marriages
begin.
End. Yeah, that's what I was about to say.
But the song playing for us was Fool's Russian. And I think there was, in our own way, a kind of a desire to hold some awareness of this is a very hard thing that we're doing, but also to sort of to hope in a way that held that awareness seemed like a deeper and truer way to hope. And one of the things that I describe in the book is that sometimes, you know, in the early stages of my divorce, I would lean so hard on a kind of ironic or cynical tone about my own marriage. Like I would lead with that detail of like, we walk down the aisle to Fool's Rush In as a way of almost knowing better than my younger self, knowing the things that she didn't, calling her a fool in some way. And I think part of the process of writing this book for me, and it's coming up for me again in terms of thinking about this larger cultural conversation, is like really how to not dismiss the hope that that woman brought to that Vegas wedding aisle when she walked down to Fool's Rush In, how to actually honor that hope, how to honor even that, you know, as we've sort of absorbed this truth that marriage, that divorce is not uncommon, how to actually hold on to what is durable and not foolish at all about bringing real hope and effort and work and faith and care to the possibility of long-term partnership.
You know, one of the things you do so beautifully is marry the sort of anger and sadness of a post-divorce situation with the beauty and specific moments of a blossoming love. And we have like a little passage from the beginning of the book that I was hoping you could read that kind of does that.
Yeah, I'm glad to read it, and I'll preface it with like a phenomenal piece of writing advice that also doubled as life advice that I got from the memoirist Mary Carr, who, Tracy, you so beautifully laid out some of the kind of contemporary narratives of divorce that have been circulating, and Mary Carr's book Lit, which is a phenomenal account of drinking and recovery, is also a really beautiful. I think of it as a kind of older godmother in the community of divorce narratives. Anyway, Mary told me, you know, you don't write the pain of divorce by writing what was difficult about the divorce. You write the pain of divorce by writing the love that came before. And that advice, when she read an early draft of Splinters, was part of what really took me deeply back into some of these moments of joy and hope that I'm going to read from. Falling in love with C was not gradual. Falling in love with C was encompassing, consuming, life-expanding. It was like ripping hunks from a loaf of fresh bread and stuffing them in my mouth. In those early days, he was a man frying little discs of sausage on a hot plate in a Paris garret, asking me to marry him, making me laugh so hard I slipped off our red couch. Loving the smoked tacos we got from a tiny shack just north of Morro Bay, pointing out backyard chickens from the garage we rented behind a surfer's bachelor pad, putting his hand on my thigh while I drank contrast fluid that tasted like bitter Gatorade before a CT scan to find my burst ovarian cyst. Playing the nitty-gritty dirt band on a road trip, putting a cinnamon bear on our rental car dashboard because it was our mascot, our trusty guide, our thing. We had a thousand things, like everyone. But ours were only ours. Who will find them beautiful now? In those early days, he was a man ordering room service steak at the Golden Nugget after we said our vows in a Vegas wedding chapel at midnight. He was a man curled beside me watching our favorite obstacle course program on TV, a man getting my face tattooed on his biceps, a man whispering in my ear at a crowded party. He is still that man. I am still that woman. We have betrayed those tender people, but we still carry them around inside of us wherever we go.
That was Leslie Jameson reading from her book Splinters, Another Kind of Love Story. Her other books, of course, include The Empathy Exams. We're also joined by Tracy Clark Flory, author of Want Me, A Sex Writer's Journey into the Heart of Desire. I just want to say, Leslie, who will find them beautiful now? Literally everyone who heard that passage, that's who will find them beautiful. We would love to hear from you about how your ideas about divorce have changed over time, or maybe you've gotten divorced. What did you learn in that experience? You can email us, maybe it's easier to write about it, forum@kqed.org, or you can give us a call, 866-733-6786. I'm Alexis Madrigal. If you want to go on our digital community on Discord, you could also probably find some people who you could talk to there as well. You could go on our Instagram, or again, the number is 866-733-6786. We'll be back with more right after the break.
Support for Forum is sponsored by Stanford's Master of Liberal Arts program. Have you found yourself reflecting on your life and education? Perhaps you think it's too late or you're too busy to earn a master's degree. Stanford's part-time MLA program is designed for anyone, from recent college grads to retirees, who'd like to pursue an interdisciplinary course of study in the liberal arts. MLA students also enjoy access to the world-class facilities on the Stanford campus. Information session held May 16th. Learn more at mla.stanford.edu.
Welcome back to Forum. I'm Alexis Madrigal. We're talking about women and divorce, which is a topic dealt with in a number of high-profile memoirs as well as big magazine pieces. We're joined by Tracy Clark Flory, journalist, essayist, author of Want Me, A Sex Writer's Journey into the Heart of Desire. Her newsletter, which I think is absolutely a must-read, is found at tracyclarkflory.substack.com. We're also joined by Leslie Jameson, author of one of those high-profile memoirs, Splinters, Another Kind of Love Story. We're going to get to more of your calls and comments about divorce. But first, you know, Leslie, in some of the Q&As that I've read with some of the authors of these books, one of the things I've noticed is that they often say that after they got divorced, other women come up to them like Sara Boche and are like, tell me about divorce. Tell me about this secret knowledge. Did that happen to you too?
That's such a great question. And it yes is the answer. And I think it reminded me in a way that I haven't fully processed explicitly before this moment of the way that I got sober 13 years ago. Mm. And a very similar thing would happen in really throughout sobriety when it's not that I think of myself as a real proselytizer, but I did write a book about it. But it's a, yeah.
There's so a, people are aware.
Yeah. People are aware. And even before that, people would come up, and it was a sort of way of trying on an alternate version of their own lives through you, trying on an alternate version of life in which they were sober. What would that be like? And then, yes, absolutely. People, I feel honored in a way to be an early resource for people who are sort of not only asking about my experience, but also looking for somebody who can hear them try to imagine or try to just wrestle with the decision in a way that maybe they know could hold or understand or not judge them if they did come to that place of wanting to end the marriage. And, you know, people have also, I've probably given out the number of my divorce lawyer like 10, 12 times.
Wow.
But I think it's also important, and I think it's lovely that you brought up Emily Gould's essay in New York Magazine, because I think it's valuable to have all kinds of stories out there. I think a kind of polyculture of stories creates a world in which it's okay to live a life in many different directions. But I love that Emily told a story of approaching the threshold of divorce and then coming back, because another thing I've noticed in these conversations is that sometimes when somebody talks to me about the possibility of getting divorced, there's almost a kind of shame that can come if they do decide to stay in their marriage. Like, I now see their marriage as something kind of irreparably flawed or tainted, when of course I don't. I think it's a beautiful story to tell the story and to live the story of kind of going to the brink and then saying, look, we're going to make this work. So I
that they themselves might have thought, well, if I thought of divorce, that must mean I need to go through with it.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Yeah. Let's bring in Lisa in Oakland here. Hey, Lisa, welcome.
Hi. So I'm calling in kind of, my story is about people who get involved in interracial relationships and the kind of dynamics that happen in those. I had a friend who was an African-American woman, and I'm African-American as well, and she was married to a Caucasian man, and they ended up getting divorced. But over the course of the process of her divorce, she started to realize a lot of things that she did not anticipate, that perhaps the man she had married was signaling his liberalism, his cosmopolitanism by having an African-American wife. And even though he projected this liberalism and that he was, you know, a pseudo-feminist, he brought into the marriage a lot of the patriarchal ideals, misogynoir, his fetishism about Black women, and that eventually eroded the marriage. So I think the divorce rate is higher among people who are married to people in their considered out groups, and I think those dynamics are really important to discuss as well. Because
Lisa, what did you tell your friend?
When you're married, you don't think. What did I tell her? I was like, so I mean, I told her like, this is not your fault, and like you did not get married to get divorced. That's what I said to her. But I was like, but this is also you knew that this was a possibility, and I guess. Like, you don't want to believe that's a possibility when you love someone. You want to give them the benefit of the doubt. And it's sad, because if you're a woman of color, you have to always ask in the back of your mind, what does he like about me exactly?
Oh, man, Lisa. Thanks for bringing that part of the conversation to us. I mean, these like structural realities seeping in through what even can feel kind of like a watertight relationship. You know, it's, I mean, I think it might be easier to take this on a purely more gender angle here. What happens when people start to see patriarchy show up in their relationships? I mean, I feel like so many of the stories that are about women in marriage right now are about that specifically.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think that this line about an ostensibly progressive man who, you know, then inside marriage, you start to see actually all of these inequities and these very sort of traditional dynamics show up despite his, you know, ostensible feminism is something that I noticed across a lot of these narratives, including the divorce memoirs, including Molly Roden Winter's recent More, which is about her polyamorous marriage. You know, her polyamory is in part a response to the inequity, the domestic inequities within their relationship, the fact that she's doing the wealth of the childcare and the chores within the house, and that polyamory becomes this outlet, this way for her to escape her role as a mother and a wife. And she saw herself as like, you know, we are a progressive family, like, you know, and then, well, in reality, this is how it often plays out.
Yeah. You know, Leslie, your book makes kind of passing mention of some of these things, but it's really kind of like around the edges. Was that not a dynamic of your marriage that you were thinking about a lot? Or did you just decide that, you know, you wanted to talk about, you know, the heart's impossibly intricate fractal shape matching up with somebody else's and kind of the forgotten milk and clothes on the bathroom floor, like kind of detracted from that?
I'm never not writing about the heart's impossibly intricate fractal shape. So thank you for witnessing that, Alexis. No, I mean, it's fascinating to think about how domestic labor kind of plays into. I think domestic labor is absolutely one of the ways that larger structural forces, as you say, kind of seep into even the relationship that feels most emotionally solid or watertight. And I can say that another sort of sotto voce thing that has come to me and that I certainly felt in the dynamic of my own marriage and its rupture is that ending a marriage, even if this is never the reason one does it, can feel like a kind of x-ray of the apportioning of domestic responsibilities, where it's like often the woman coming out of the divorce feels that domestic life has gotten a lot easier because they are maybe still doing all
Tracy
the chores
nodding hard
the
over here.
Yeah. Whereas the man might feel that domestic life has gotten a lot harder. And there's a way that is just like, well, yeah, because who is doing most of the work and all that kind of unofficial work that isn't getting tallied anywhere? So, yes, I think in writing my own book, I was really concerned for both literary and ethical reasons with not wanting to write a book that was kind of litigating a case against anyone. And I was really interested more than anything in the kind of emotional work of rebuilding a life once the life that I had believed in had ended. But I do believe very deeply in writing the kind of rumpled clothes on the bathroom floor and the baby spit up and, you know, the blood clots in the hospital floor after giving birth. So I think that for me, the work of the heart is always entangled with the kind of work of a life and the material realities of a life. And so to the extent that I was trying to write some of the exhaustion of that domestic labor, it was an important part of the emotional experience I was writing, even if it wasn't. I very much didn't want it to be directed as a kind of case against anyone or an attempt to get a reader kind of to be like a girlfriend on my side in a bar. That wasn't the kind of relationship I wanted to have with the reader. Yeah. But I think that the work of making a home and the way in which that work felt, for me at least, a lot freer and in many ways easier after the end of my marriage was a part of the story.
You know, to your point on how you thought about the ethics of writing about a marriage and a divorce, Tony in San Francisco, welcome.
Hi, Alexis. Thanks for having me. Thank you so much for the subject today and all the voices, everyone who's talking about this from a writer's standpoint. I'm curious to know if you can maybe speak to from a creative standpoint as a writer and really kind of in the emotional depths of really kind of telling these stories, thinking so much in retrospect, but also considering also your emotional experience in the present. How does one really kind of manage basically the present and eventually the future when you tell a story with such intensity, perhaps such passion, and just being honest to that story for what it is, and consider the person that you're with currently.
From a
personal perspective, I'm concerned about that. Both stories mean everything to me. But from a creative writing standpoint, I'd like to know what others think.
Leslie, you want to start with this? And then Tracy, I think you should take this too, having written the book and the kind of work that you do as well.
Yeah, it's a great question and a question that, I've wrestled with for a decade and feel very much, you know, not that I've wrestled it to the ground like a beast that I've triumphed over, but that I, you know, wrestle with it continuously. I have two things to say, and one is about the process of crafting the manuscript, the sort of creative work of writing it, and then the second is a kind of a part of my process once I've written the manuscript. And I guess just to stick with this book, Splinters, as a kind of case study, I spent about 5 years drafting this book, and part of the desire to create many drafts was the strong feeling that it was only through drafting and redrafting that I was going to be able to come to a version of the story that was not engined by my resentments or engined by the desire to make a case against somebody, and that I would be able to figure out across the work of revision what belonged and what needed to be kept in life. You know, the wonderful writer Hanifa Duracube writes about this act of making art from what one has lived. Mm-hmm. And he describes it as like, you know, if your life is a house, and I apologize if I'm paraphrasing him wrong, but I've absorbed his wisdom and in this way. He says, you know, you're basically taking readers into one room of the house. And in that room, you're showing them everything. You're showing them what's under the sheets. Mm-hmm. You're showing them what's under the cupboards. You're showing them the dusty parts, the hidden parts, that, you know, can of tuna you haven't looked at for 10 years. But that you're not showing them the rest of it.
They don't get to go upstairs.
Yeah. And so I, you know, it's like when a reader reads my work, they often feel such an intimate experience that they feel like they're getting everything. They feel like they're getting the whole story. And I want them to feel that sense of totality. I want them to feel that they are getting something whole. But I know how much for both aesthetic and kind of personal reasons I've chosen to leave out. So I guess that's one point about the kind of part, using parts of life to create a story that feels total. And then I'll just say the brief version of this, but I do share my manuscripts with everybody who appears in them well before publication, and we have conversations about what's there. And that's been an important part of, and it's sometimes a very difficult part of my process for a long time.
Yeah, I mean, I have a similar process that I did with my memoir, which is a sexual coming-of-age memoir, which introduced a lot of awkwardness in that, you know, I had to go to people that I was no longer talking to and say, hey, I'm writing about you. You're in my book, you know, want to take a look. But I think
did they take you up on it usually, or were they like, you know what, I'm good.
Yeah, I kind of, there were most people that were like, no, that's fine. You know, I'll check it out when it's published. And then a couple of people read it. But I tried really, you know, I tried to be very fair and honest in my handling. And so no one objected to what I'd written. But to speak to the caller's question about like how you write something like that and then deal with your current relationships, you know, like as a wife, as a mother, publishing a sexual coming of age memoir, and then having that, you know, the discomfort of having your partner read about that past, which can be very painful sometimes. And then also it, you know, something like a sexual coming of age memoir showing up, you know, at kids' birthday parties when people ask about, you know, what's your book about?
You're like, well, let's come over here.
Yeah. Oh my God, it would be literally my dream that somehow small talk at a kid's birthday party could result in talking about a sexual coming of age memoir. That'd be amazing.
We have some really interesting comments coming in from, you know, people at different ages and in different stages of life talking about their divorces. One listener wrote, you know, I'm in my late 60s. I divorced in my early 30s, finished college, and began working in the public sector in the Bay Area. I worked for various cities and counties over a 15-year period as a divorcee and parent of three. During this time, I experienced subtle and overt discrimination. It surfaced in assignments, equitable pay raises, and promotions. Eventually, I left and started my own software company, Yet Another World, with biases against women. I'm not bitter or regretful. These experiences made me more compassionate and stronger. Another person here, another listener writes, after two divorces, one in my 20s and one at 48 with two tween children, I figured out the perfect way to live. Co-parent children with a platonic partner living separately so each can have much-needed me time, and then, maybe, marry when they're grown and flown. Raising children in a love-based marriage is hard to nearly impossible. Having a romantic relationship or marriage later in life, I'm in my 60s, is joyous. What do you think? I find that, like, totally fascinating, and one of the things that I was thinking about, that what people are getting from divorce memoirs is, you know, particularly the ones that involve children and just like the burdens and pressures that children bring into a marriage. It's like you don't have the marriage that you had before you had kids. You have something else. You might have something else that's totally beautiful and amazing. But we probably don't take enough time to sort of – a baby moon is not enough time to mourn the fact that you do not have the marriage you had before you had children, you know?
Well, and I think it's interesting. I think across all of the examples that we brought up today – all of these narratives involve children. Like, they're all written by mothers, as far as I can tell. You know, so that's a huge piece of it. These are the stories we're telling, not just about divorce, but about, you know, divorce within the context of married motherhood.
Why do you think that is?
Oh, my gosh. I mean, you know... So to point to Liz Lenz's book, This American Ex-Wife, you know, and also to point back to something that Leslie had said earlier, she really uses her story as an example of how much easier things are for her. And this is not always the case, but for her as a single mother, she finds that she has less work to do. She finds that she's, you know, doing less chores because she's not picking up after another grown adult who doesn't pick up after himself. And, you know, she says basically court-mandated 50-50 custody was the only way to get her now ex-husband to do his fair share of childhood. You know, so I think that really speaks to the inequities, the domestic inequities that a lot of women experience. I mean, it's not just anecdotal in these memoirs. It's statistically, like again and again and again, it's shown that women do much more childcare. They do much more, you know, in the way of chores around the house. And that's true when they're working full-time jobs. It doesn't change.
Yeah. It's also really interesting because you also then look at stats for men spending time with their kids. And of course, relative to our fathers, we're spending way more time with our kids, but also still, you know, it's important to keep in mind that broader context of like, and still, and yet, it may feel like you're doing more and also. We're talking about women and divorce, topic of some really fascinating high-profile memoirs, including Leslie Jamison's Splinters, Another Kind of Love Story. We're also joined by Tracy Clark Flory, journalist and essayist and author of Want Me, A Sex Writer's Journey into the Heart of Desire. I'd love to hear, if you're a woman who's been reading or seeing the different media that has come out about divorce, what are you getting from it or what are you connecting with it, whether you're divorced or married? And give us a call. The number is 866-733-6786, or you can email us forum@kqed.org. The number is 866-733-6786. I'm Alexis Madrigal. Stay tuned.
At Star One Credit Union, you're first because they put you first. Ranked number one in the nation for direct financial benefit to their members 10 years and counting. Star One invests in your best interest with the latest banking technology, an authentic human experience, and effortlessly simple everyday banking solutions that put you first. They also believe in giving back, donating to over 70 Bay Area organizations annually. Become a member at StarOne.org or drop by any of their Bay Area locations. Star One Credit Union, in your best interest.
Welcome back to Forum. I'm Alexis Madrigal. We're joined this morning by Leslie Jamison, author of Splinters, Another Kind of Love Story. Other books include, of course, The Empathy Exam, which is also amazing. Also joined by Tracy Clark Flory, journalist, essayist, and author of Want Me, A Sex Writer's Journey into the Heart of Desire. Her newsletter, which is awesome, is at tracyclarkflory.substack.com. We'll get to more of your comments. Maybe it seems like it's a little easier for people to write them out. So maybe it's forum at kqed.org. You can tell us how your divorce changed you or what you learned in that process. We have another reading from you, Leslie, that I thought maybe we could get to. And you could maybe set it up. It's from the very end of the book, as you know, or close to the end. But I also don't think it's a spoiler.
It's not really a spoiler. It's not really a spoiler book.
No,
yeah.
No, I think it,
yeah. Yeah, it's actually, I think it's connected to some of what we were talking about before the break about the role of motherhood in these narratives of divorce that are in circulation and mm-hmm. the way that part of the experience that I was trying to write about in Splinters was kind of how to hold all of these different selves and roles inside of me at once, how to be at once a mother, a wife, and then an ex-wife, a teacher, a friend, a daughter who was very shaped by the story of my own parents' marriage and divorce, also like a lover once I, you know, started to explore that part of my identity again after the end of marriage. And so the book sort of lands in this place of trying to both live inside of this like consuming, ferocious love I felt and still feel for my daughter, but also how to come to a sense of that love that didn't have to be totalizing and like leave no room or oxygen for anything else, which is like kind of one of the ideas that sometimes we get implicitly or explicitly about what good mothering is, right? That you sort of sacrifice everything at its altar. This is a moment with my daughter near the end of the book. Part of me felt flooded with sufficiency. We're standing there holding hands in a road. Sunlight could fall on a patch of tar on a country road, and we could stand there and have everything we needed. It was enough. Another part of me knew it was okay to want more than just our clasped hands, to want twisted sheets in a Houston hotel room and quiet mornings at my laptop, tap, tap, tapping at my keyboard while grad students read Marxist theory at sidewalk tables below. It was okay to want cigarettes at the beach and bone broth underground. My daughter broke me open for the whole world. She broke me open for everything that wasn't her.
Beautiful. That was Leslie Jameson reading from her book Splinters, Another Kind of Love Story. Tracy, I feel like in your work you also are exploring, you know, the seams that people have on their between their different identities or different roles that they're playing. And I think one that comes up a lot in a lot of these narratives is the way that like romance itself or the romantic partner gets sort of overwhelmed by everything else that goes on in building a life together.
Yeah. I mean, that's definitely a theme in my work. And it's part of one of the many things that I love so much about Leslie's book is that, you know, she really holds this like contradiction that's kind of inherent within the culture of motherhood, that like, you know, the idea of that you are a mother and also a lover, but also like that the contradiction of like the difficulty of single motherhood, but also the beauty of it and just like sitting right in that in between. And, you know, it brings to mind for me something that Leslie said earlier about going into a marriage with this sense of irony and this sort of distancing. And that was so much my experience of motherhood in the initial stages was like ironic motherhood. It was motherhood with air quotes. It was like,
I love my kid.
It's like, I'm that mom with her, you know, nursing her baby.
And with it was a like stroller who hasn't slept a lot.
Exactly. Yeah, and it was like, and there's a distancing to that. And it's also just this, like, you know, the way that it can, you can just not feel like you fit within this idea of motherhood. And I think part of, you know, coming to find yourself within motherhood can be like, as her book ends with this moment of like holding all these contrasts and contradictions and tensions.
Yeah. Let's bring in another caller. Ree in Berkeley. Welcome.
Oh, hi. Thank you for taking my call. This is a great show. I am likewise a divorcee who benefited time-wise my divorce. It was really freeing. But since that time, it's been 15 years now, I realized part of what was difficult for me was that I was basically forced to be an isolated dyad with my spouse. And so all of the labor was mine. To a community where multiple people might share a kitchen and share community and support. And so this culture demands this weird isolation. And I think that's part of the destructiveness.
Yeah. Hey, thanks so much for that. You know, I think I want to bounce that to you is that this seems to be largely, although not exclusively, a phenomenon of heterosexual couples, right? I mean, I know that there are queer couples out there who have imbalances in their domestic labors and they get divorced, and all those things. But the specific dynamics that we're talking about here do seem to be, like, they're recurring still largely within, quote-unquote, nuclear family. And there's a dude and there's a woman and they're married and these things are happening. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think one of the things that's interesting is that the research shows that generally same-sex couples on the whole have a more equitable balance of, you know, domestic chores and the like, with the exception of when there's a baby involved, when there's a kid involved. The kid shows up and then things start to sort of tilt in one direction or the other, where one person sort of takes on more of those domestic responsibilities. And I think that really speaks to the way that our world is, built and organized, that, like, the American workforce is not very friendly to families, you know? And so inevitably, like, someone has to end up taking the role of the quote-unquote wife and mom to sort of pick up the slack.
There's a couple, a pair of friends of mine who play a role in my, a very heroic role in my narrative, a beautiful.
Catherine and Casey.
They show up with their power tools and help me put together my furniture. They bring me and my daughter down in the early months of the pandemic to sort of get out of New York City and spend some time in their, like, beautiful farmhouse in Maryland. And they are 100% as heroic as they seem in these pages. They're lovely people. But at a certain moment in the narrative, I sort of catch myself projecting this impossible level of fantasy onto their relationship with each other that I think is a fantasy that I've projected also onto, like, the alternate version of me that was lesbian. Like, I wish I could have been lesbian because then I would have had, you know, domestic equality and not these issues. But that's just not, you know, not how I roll. But I had to sort of both, that I had to recognize not only that, you know, they have their own share of troubles, but that the kind of the fantasy isn't really about them. The fantasy is located in me and the fantasy is about domestic equality or kind of fumbling towards that somehow more successfully.
I think the fantasy could also be about them. They're pretty. I mean, for those who want to hear at least one member of that family, Catherine Schultz was on the show for Lost and Found. It's a great, great show and amazing book as well. Another listener writes in to say, I was divorced in 2013 and it was the absolute best decision of my life. Yes, I have two amazing daughters as a result of the marriage, which I am beyond grateful for. However, the best thing I have shown them is that if the relationship is not healthy, you can get out of it. And there is life past divorce. Since then, I've come to understand that not only was there emotional abuse, there was also physical abuse in the house. And I had both friends saying to me both, good for you, and then how dare you bring me into this family's life. I feel sad for that friend who felt her own relationship was threatened by my divorce. I think there's a lot in that comment. I think maybe the first thing to say is obviously if people are in an abusive situation, it's kind of different from what we're talking about, I think, or what you, I mean, I assume what you think you're talking about in the book. But also, what is your family history of these things, right? Because do you feel, I know your parents got divorced. Do you feel like that they showed you that if a relationship is not healthy, you can get out of it? Like, was that something you took away from them?
Yeah, I was really hearing that. I'm loving hearing these responses from listeners. They're really beautiful. And, I think it takes something to share your story in this way. So I just wanted to recognize that as well. I was really listening hard to that part of it, that feeling that, you know, we managed to show our kids that it's not the only worthwhile thing to show our kids, right? A marriage that lasts forever and never breaks, that the choice to end something that isn't working can also be a valuable thing to model for your children. And as a daughter, I absolutely felt that. I mean, my parents have a somewhat unusual story, or maybe it's just unusual because we don't hear it told enough. But they were married for 22 years and had three kids, and then got divorced. And about a decade after their divorce, they really rebuilt a quite powerful friendship that they've now been inside of for several decades. And watching their relationship kind of phase change across these different iterations was so powerful for me, both to see them make the choice, not that it's the only choice they could have made, but it was a really powerful and I think generative and helpful choice for them to make to end their marriage. And then to see that it wasn't the end for them. It wasn't the end for them as parents, of course, but it wasn't even the end for their dynamic. They somehow exist even more powerfully as kind of friends who were once married. And so that to me was just like one, not only a modeling of like how they made a choice that was, I think, in the end, a really beautiful choice for our family, but also like this idea that like just because something ends doesn't mean both that the goodness of what it was no longer exists, but it also it can just be a kind of a birth canal or a transformation to the relationship finding new footing. That was, you know, I don't want to be a Pollyanna about it. It's not always how it goes. It's not always how it can go. But to know even that that was possible, it just isn't a story we hear as much about.
Yeah. Another listener writes and say, about a year ago, me and my husband of over 25 years were in a very difficult place. I was barely surviving and still parenting our primary school age child. We've endured some huge challenges, but that time a year ago didn't necessarily seem surmountable, and I'm an optimist. We had some very difficult conversations, have consciously tried to better communicate since then, and more. We're in a better place now, and now I find so many friends I'm able to support because that difficult time made it easier for me to be vulnerable and share with others. Makes a lot of sense to me. Another just kind of a wrenching story. Diana writes, I was married for 15 years when I got divorced. Two kids, ages 3 and 7 at the time of the divorce. For me, the divorce was sudden and shocking. I found out my husband was having an affair and living a double life. It shattered my world and led to much soul searching and growth on my part on how I could live with and love someone for so long and not know them at all. I felt such relief the day he moved out, like a huge weight I didn't realize I was carrying around was lifted off of me, but divorce hasn't been the end. We've been in and out of court for the past 7 years. Let's say, I think, you know, your book is not about that particular topic, but it is about sort of the people that are inside of us that you meet as time goes on, kind of like our first caller, Lisa, you know, these different selves come out and suddenly people go, wait, did I know you at all? Even though people have been married for a very long time.
Yeah, I mean, I'm absolutely interested in the ways that we continue to surprise ourselves and surprise like the people closest to us across the course of our lives. And I think sometimes that can be dark and traumatic and deeply damaging. We've heard a couple of different stories about sort of, you know, the secret life that reveals itself, or the sort of dark underbelly of ostensibly progressive liberalism, or, you know, so the secret selves aren't always like selves that it feels good to meet. But I think there are also ways that divorce, like many kinds of kind of crisis or rupture or passing through thresholds of transformation, can sort of make a different kind of space for different aspects of a self to kind of to show up or announce themselves. And I, at one point, I write about this kind of incredible story that my mother told me about. My mother worked in public health for many years and then eventually became an Episcopal deacon. And the first time she ever consciously voiced that vocational calling for like a life in the church was actually in an argument with my father near the end of their marriage, where she said, "You don't know me at all. For all you know, I might want to become a priest." And I was so interested by that speech act that it was like, I think it kind of only could have happened with him, that she was interested in saying, look, there are parts of me that you don't know. There are parts of me that even I don't know. And that part of what the rupture of their marriage actually made room for was for that part of her to express itself more fully.
Tracy, this one is coming to you. Another listener writes to say, when you first get married, It's for a 1 to 3 year term. If everyone is still happy at the end of the first term, you extend for an additional 3 to 5 year term and so on. If it doesn't work out the terms of your separation, how things are split, child custody, and everything else is worked out while all parties are still in love and care for each other and willing to negotiate in good faith rather than vengeance. I mean, a kind of utopian legalistic scenario here. It gets to the question of, should marriage just be different? Like, should the conception of marriage, like what goes, you know, we have like property rights and there's a certain set of things right. In there. Should just like marriage have a different set of things inside
it? Well, and also just like hearing that comment, I'm kind of like, why are we getting married? you know what I mean?
Like, well, just to see if it works for 1 to 3 years.
Right. And so I guess in that sense, it's like, well, okay, are there other ways that we could structure our world that would actually make marriage, this legal contract between two people, not necessary? You know, could we design our world in a different way where people didn't feel the need to enter into this legal agreement, you know?
Right. I mean, well, part of it is the reality, you know, there's this meme that a friend sent me that said 90% of Brooklyn polyamory is actually a real estate dilemma. If they had money, they would move out and do divorced monogamy, right? I mean, I think that's maybe why people
right,
are getting
that. Right. I mean, there's great security that often comes along with being married and, you know, tax breaks and all these things that, like, you know, really encourage us to enter into this particular agreement. Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that was something that came up a lot with Molly Roden Winter's More, the polyamory memoir. You know, a lot of people have been mentioning the socioeconomic mm-hmm. backdrop of it, that she lives in a brownstone in Park Slope, you know, that, you know, to have the sort of ability to facilitate polyamory with hotel rooms and that sort of thing, like that there's a certain privilege often that comes with exploring different modes of being that aren't, you know, immediately available for a lot of people.
Yeah. Kate writes in one last comment here, just like kind of a nice final thought. Kate writes, the thing that has irked and perplexed me since my divorce is that in conversation, in dating, even in surveys and questionnaires, I'm expected to say I'm, quote, divorced because there was a divorce in my past. As far as I'm concerned, divorce is an event, not a relationship status. It's amazing just in the grammar that like reveals something very important about how we see this event. Yeah.
And that it would be defining.
Yeah,
you know?
Permanently attached on your permanent record.
It's so true that those questionnaires, like every other way you could mark it, is about how things are, not what happened in the past.
Yeah. We've been talking about women and divorce, a topic that's of a number of high-profile memoirs, including one of our guests, Leslie Jamison, her book Splinters, Another Kind of Love Story. Absolutely beautiful book. Thank you so much for joining us, Leslie.
Thanks for having me.
We've also been joined by Tracy Clark Flory, journalist, essayist, author of the Substack, tracyclarkflory.substack.com, and the book Want Me, A Sex Writer's Journey into the Heart of Desire. Thank you so much for joining us, Tracy.
Thanks so much for having me.
TCF on the show. So fun. I'm Alexis Madrigal. Stay tuned for another hour of Forum with Mina Kim.
Funds for the production of KQED's Forum are provided by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the Generosity Foundation, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Heising Simons Foundation.
Take your Wi-Fi further with wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity. With fast speeds and reliable coverage, home just got even sweeter with the Xfinity 10G network. Restrictions apply, not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary.